From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Yesterday, Massachusetts took another step toward becoming the first state to legalize gay marriage. The state's highest court ruled that only full equal marriage rights for gay couples, as opposed to civil unions, would be constitutional in that state. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Raphael Lewis, who covers the Massachusetts state legislature for the Boston Globe. Then we'll hear how Vermont became the first state to legalize gay civil unions. We talk with David Motes, author of the new book Civil Wars, A Battle for Gay Marriage. He's the editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald in Vermont and won a Pulitzer Prize for his editorials about civil unions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. CIA Director George Tenet defended his agency's intelligence gathering about Iraq's weapons programs today. Tenet said his analysts were straightforward with the administration about what they knew and where they disagreed.
When the facts of Iraq are all in, we will neither be completely right nor completely wrong.
Tenet said his agency never told the administration that Saddam Hussein's regime posed an imminent threat to the United States. President Bush is expected to name his commission to investigate Iraq war intelligence tomorrow, and there are reports that Republican Senator John McCain will be one of the president's choices. Democratic officials say former House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt will endorse the presidential campaign of Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. The endorsement could help Kerry gain the support of labor unions that backed Gephardt before he dropped out of the race. Kerry held a rally in Maine today, 3 days before voters there attend caucuses. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Kerry visited a Boys and Girls Club in Portland, Maine, where he talked about the importance of early childhood education. He also picked up the endorsement of Maine Governor John Baldacci. Baldacci, who was injured in an auto accident this week, spoke at the rally via telephone. Kerry's also being endorsed today by former Maine Senator George Mitchell. From Portland, the Kerry campaign moves on to Michigan, which holds its caucuses on Saturday. Kerry himself makes a short detour to New York for a fundraiser. His campaign has brought in $5 million since the beginning of the year, $4.5 million of that since his victory in the Iowa caucuses. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Portland, Maine.
Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean is pulling his campaign workers out of Michigan. Dean said he's concentrating his efforts on Wisconsin.
We think that we ought to go to Wisconsin. We've made it clear this is our stand. This is where we intend to fight, and this is where we intend to win.
Howard Dean made his comment in an interview with Melissa Block on NPR's All Things Considered today. Investigators are still trying to determine how the deadly poison ricin got into a Senate office building. Capitol Police Chief Terrence Gaynor said it's not clear how the toxin was delivered, and he noted that it didn't necessarily come in the mail.
The possibilities for the delivery mechanism, whether it's a person or a letter or a package, is open, and we got to work through that.
The poison was found in the mailroom in the office of Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. Frist said yesterday that the powdery substance was found on the tray of a letter-opening machine. So far, no one has fallen ill from the poison, but some Senate staffers have been asked to take blood tests to see whether they've been exposed. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 24 points to close at 10,495. The Nasdaq was up 5 points. It closed at 2019. This is NPR News. The Pentagon says it's scrapping a plan for soldiers and other Americans overseas to vote by Internet. A report from computer security experts who reviewed the system said it was vulnerable to attacks by hackers who could tamper with votes or steal personal information about the voters. The Archbishop of Boston has accused the highest court in Massachusetts of usurping the role of the legislature in its ruling on gay marriage. Monica Brady-Meyeroff reports from member station WBUR.
Archbishop Sean O'Malley called on all Catholic citizens to, quote, unite and take action to defend marriage. Wednesday, the state's highest court ruled a civil union bill for gay couples would be unconstitutional, paving the way for gay marriages in the state as early as May. In a written statement, O'Malley said the majority on the court has an overly activist stance that dismissed the issues raised by dissenting justices. O'Malley says marriage is and always will be a union between a man and a woman. He asked Catholics to contact their representatives and urge them to bring a constitutional amendment to the floor next week at the state's constitutional convention. If an amendment is approved, it would not appear on the ballot until 2006. For NPR News, I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov in Boston.
NASA says the Mars rover Opportunity has begun exploring the red planet. The rover traveled about 10 feet last night, its first movement since leaving its lander over the weekend. Mission managers say they want to know more about the pebbles that Opportunity is rolling over because some scientists think they could have been formed by sea erosion. And the two rovers, Opportunity and Spirit, are on opposite sides of Mars looking for evidence of water. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, Massachusetts took a big step toward becoming the first state in the country to legalize gay marriage. Last November, the state's highest court ruled that the state's marriage laws needed to be updated within 6 months so as not to exclude people of the same sex from marrying. The Massachusetts Senate asked the court if a bill giving same-sex couples the right to form civil unions would be sufficient. Yesterday, the court said no, civil unions would create, quote, an unconstitutional, inferior, and discriminatory status for same-sex couples. Separate is seldom, if ever, equal. Unquote. This ruling was different from the one in Vermont, in which the highest court told the legislature that the state was required to extend the benefits of marriage to same-sex couples, but those benefits could be offered through civil unions. We'll talk about how Vermont legalized civil unions in the second half of the show. Although the Massachusetts legislature is now required to legalize gay marriage, it is also expected to debate an amendment to the state constitution that would restrict marriage to heterosexual couples. Earlier today, I spoke with Raphael Lewis. He covers the Massachusetts legislature for the Boston Globe. On what grounds does the High Court of Massachusetts have the authority to tell the legislature, to define for the legislature, what it needs to do in terms of gay marriage?
The High Court in Massachusetts is the ultimate arbiter of what is constitutional in the state. Because the legislature never dealt with the issue of gay marriage and with defining marriage, the court was left in the position to say who can get married and who can't. The laws here, the marriage laws, don't say anything explicitly about men and women being the only ones allowed to get married. They don't say that marriage is for procreation, for creating families, and all the things that a lot of people do think of marriage as being about. So the court said, well, absent that kind of language and absent any kind of definition, we look to the state constitution, and the state constitution says that we're all equal under the law, and therefore we see no reason to deny same-sex couples civil marriage rights.
If gay marriage is legalized in Massachusetts, that would give gay spouses the opportunity to challenge the Defense of Marriage Act, because you'd need to be married in order to challenge the act. Do you think that before such a challenge is posed, that there would be a hunt for, you know, just the right test case, you know, for a couple that would make a great test case?
Yes, I do believe that based on what happened here in Massachusetts, the lawyers found seven ideal couples for the case that ultimately led to the legalization of gay marriage here. Not so much for the judges, I don't believe, but for the media view and just the public's view. Here were seven couples that were very stable, professional, good members of their community with children, homeowners, and were able to exemplify many of the needs of married couples, you know, involving owning a home, probate issues, inheritance, hospital visitation. One of the couples, when one woman was having her baby, the other mother couldn't get into the emergency room, and so they will choose very carefully.
So as a result of the test case, the High Court said that the laws didn't adequately address this issue, and it demanded that the legislature take care of that.
Yes, although the legislature doesn't necessarily have to do very much. They really just have to clean up a little language in the marriage laws that say bride and groom and things like that, and just clean up some of the forms. They really could actually sit back and do nothing at this point, and same-sex couples would still be able to get their civil marriage licenses. It wouldn't change anything in terms of church and synagogue and mosque weddings. A mosque or a church could easily deny, under this scenario, giving a marriage ceremony to a same-sex couple, but they could still go right down to the town hall and, if they qualify, get the license.
Yesterday's court decision was in response to the Massachusetts State Senate going back to the court and asking for advice on whether a civil union would be acceptable to the court or whether it had to be gay marriage. And the court said, no, it has to be gay marriage. Now, in Vermont, the opposite was the case. The state Supreme Court in Vermont said a civil union is acceptable. Can you talk about those two different models?
Within the state borders, there's not a tremendous difference between civil unions and civil marriage in the sense that a state can bestow a certain number of benefits and rights to couples that are married, and those very same rights would have been created under the Massachusetts civil union scenario. Same goes in Vermont. However, there is a large set of federal rights and benefits that go along with being married, even though that marriage certificate is granted by a town and a state. So that is the big difference between civil unions and civil marriage. That, and also, a marriage is accepted by all the other states, presumably, although there's the complicating factor of the Defense of Marriage Act. But a civil union would not necessarily be honored by another state if a couple were to visit or to eventually move or anything that might happen.
Yeah, why don't you explain how the Defense of Marriage Act affects whether other states will recognize gay marriages?
This is really the $64,000 question. The Defense of Marriage Act, which is a federal act, allowed states to define marriage for themselves and said you don't have to honor another state's marriage law if, in fact, like in Massachusetts' case, they were to honor gay marriages. However, there are plenty of constitutional scholars who believe that the Defense of Marriage Act will not hold up under a lawsuit. There's a thought that the Constitution requires states to honor the marriage licenses of each other.
This week, Ohio became the 38th state to pass legislation basically defining marriage as something that happens between a man and a woman, and prohibiting recognition of gay marriage.
Yeah, exactly. I believe only three or four states have actually put it into their constitution. But yes, 38 states have said marriage is the union of a man and a woman. The question is, would those laws hold up if a couple were to get married in Massachusetts and head back to their home state and say, we're married, we want these benefits, we want these rights? Some say those laws would hold up, including Bob Barr, the former Republican congressman who was the chief sponsor of the Defense of Marriage Act. But many others, like Larry Tribe from the Harvard Law School, says it would probably wither and die under a test.
So now that the state Supreme Court of Massachusetts has gone back to the state legislature and said civil unions aren't good enough, you have to legalize marriage between people of the same sex, what position does this put the legislators in?
Well, the legislators were really hoping, even many of the more liberal legislators in Massachusetts were really hoping that that bill was going to pass constitutional muster, because I don't think they wanted to be the first in the nation. It's an uncomfortable position, of course, to be at the vanguard, and obviously there are many who don't even agree with the idea. There's a lot of sweating going on behind the scenes right now. Lobbying groups on both sides of the issue are literally filling the hallways trying to talk to all 200 of the legislators. The Catholic Church is deeply involved in this state. 40% of the state is Catholic. So the entire archdiocese of the entire state, there's four dioceses, and they're active up here, and they're lobbying. There's sermons in the churches. No one knows what's going to happen over the next few weeks.
Do you think that some of the legislators feel that there's no middle ground for them, for the legislators who feel that gay marriage is too extreme for them to vote for, but they'd be willing to vote for civil unions they may also feel that it's too extreme to have a constitutional amendment that outlaws the legalizing of gay relationships. So do they feel that there's no acceptable position for them now?
It's safe to say that most Massachusetts lawmakers right now feel that there is no middle ground, and that's largely because there is none anymore. What the court has done has said there's gay marriage now. You can actively work to deny these couples those marriage rights, or you can do nothing, but you can't do something in the middle. And the curious thing is that here in Massachusetts, it takes several years to amend the Constitution. So we're going to have a situation here where on May 17th of this year, the 50th anniversary, by the way, of the Brown versus Board of Education vote, civil marriage certificates will be handed out to gay and lesbian couples. But it's not until the fall of 2006 that they could overturn this ruling by amending the Constitution. So there's, you know, several years here where there will be couples getting married not only from Massachusetts, but presumably from all over the country coming here to get a marriage license.
John Kerry is a senator from Massachusetts. In the past, he has supported civil unions. What does he have to say now about the Supreme Court's decision saying only gay marriage will do?
He issued a fairly brief statement yesterday saying that he disagreed with the court's decision, that he does not favor gay marriage, and that he is, however, in favor of civil unions. And I'm sure he can look forward to the day when this is going to be a liability for him, coming from Massachusetts, which is widely viewed as one of the most liberal states in the nation. The state Democratic Party committee just voted the other day to endorse gay marriage. John Kerry is actually a member of the state committee, but he wasn't there for the vote and presumably would not have signed on to it.
Now, President Bush said yesterday in reaction to the Massachusetts court's decision, marriage is a sacred institution between a man and a woman. If activist judges insist on redefining marriage by court order, the only alternative will be the constitutional process. We must do what is legally necessary to defend the sanctity of marriage. And he's referring there to the possibility of an amendment to the federal constitution that would outlaw gay marriage. I hate to ask you to be in the position of predicting the future, but how much of an issue do you think this is going to become in the presidential election?
Well, I do believe it is going to become an issue. Karl Rove, the president's chief political advisor, is obviously looking to shore up the conservative base. The conservative base was pushing very hard for the president to endorse a federal amendment banning gay marriage. He alluded to it in his State of the Union speech, but didn't go far enough for them. And now conservative groups are saying, said yesterday, and it was reported today in the New York Times, that they are getting assurances from the White House that the president will indeed endorse this. So that inherently becomes an issue. Perhaps John Kerry will take a stance where he says that's too far, that's draconian, and I don't think it's proper. We have to keep in mind that John Kerry voted against the Defense of Marriage Act that President Clinton signed.
If there is a movement to have an amendment to the federal constitution that would outlaw gay marriage, what would that mean for the nation and for the movement to legalize gay marriage?
Well, I think it sets up a very divisive culture war, not unlike the battle over abortion. You have two sides that are quite impassioned, that don't see a middle ground here, and that see any incremental steps as a tremendous erosion of their position. Just as the partial birth abortion ban was seen as the first step toward overturning Roe v. Wade, that's basically what's happening here. The people see Massachusetts as the first domino in what will ultimately be the overturning of the Defense of Marriage Act, and what some people see is the upending of thousands of years of marriage history. Gay couples, on the other hand, say, we're already gay. Many of us are already adopting. It's not changing anything but just giving us rights that any American should be afforded.
If there is an amendment to the federal constitution outlawing gay marriage, Does that end the ability of states to legalize gay marriage?
Yes, it would, definitively. The federal constitution trumps the state constitutions.
Mm-hmm. So as far as you can tell, what's the importance now of Massachusetts in the controversy over gay unions?
Massachusetts creates the wedge that same-sex marriage backers needed to challenge the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Couples can come here, get married, go back to their home states, and sue for the rights and benefits that they believe they should be afforded with those marriage licenses. It starts the series of federal discussions that will ultimately lead to either the overturning of the Defense of Marriage Act or the recognition that the Defense of Marriage Act allows states to control their own marriage laws, or the possibility that the U.S. Constitution itself would be changed.
Well, Raphael Lewis, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Raphael Lewis covers the Massachusetts State Legislature for the Boston Globe. Coming up, how Vermont became the first state to legalize gay civil unions. This is Fresh Air. Massachusetts is on its way to becoming the first state to legalize gay and lesbian marriage. Vermont was the first state to legalize civil unions for same-sex couples. My guest David Motes has written a new book about how that happened called Civil Wars, A Battle for Gay Marriage. He's the editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald in Vermont and won a Pulitzer Prize for his editorials in favor of civil unions. The issue of same-sex unions came to the Vermont courts in a test case involving three same-sex couples requesting marriage licenses. I asked Motes how the ruling of Vermont's highest court compared to the Massachusetts ruling.
The Vermont court in 1999, in December, came out with its ruling in the Baker case, which was based on the Vermont Constitution, and the court explicitly gave the choice to the legislature to either pass a law creating gay marriage or to create a parallel institution, as they called it, a domestic partnership or what became known as civil union. And the reason they were able to do that was that they were relying on a clause in the Vermont Constitution, the Common Benefits Clause, which holds that government is or ought to be instituted for the common benefit of the people and not for the benefit of one group or another. And so The Chief Justice, in that opinion, found that this is a question of benefits, not so much of rights. So if we create civil unions and that provides equal benefits, that's good enough. In the Massachusetts case, it was a case of equal rights. They weren't relying on anything like the Common Benefits Clause, and so the court held that that gay and lesbian couples have the right to marry.
Now, in the Massachusetts Supreme Court, the judges said that the history of our nation has demonstrated that separate is seldom, if ever, equal. And that was at least one of the reasons why the court said that civil unions wouldn't do, because it's separate from and therefore not equal to the concept of marriage. But the Vermont Supreme Court didn't seem to have trouble with that. Was the issue of separate but equal, or separate and therefore unequal, raised in Vermont?
Yes, it was. The advocates who, the lawyers who argued the case in Vermont, made that argument very clearly, and they said marriage is a benefit in and of itself. The word is, and everybody knows that marriage is an important institution, and so they made that case. And there was a dissent in the Vermont case. One of the justices basically agreed and said this is a civil rights case, and you know, creating a separate category is not right. But since the court was basing it on the Common Benefits Clause and was making this argument about benefits, then the court found that, well, separate could be equal. In fact, Governor Dean, during that time, his take on it was this is different but equal, and he caught some flack for that, but that's how he portrayed it. And so I've argued that separate but equal was not an accurate characterization, because in the South, in the Jim Crow South, the doctrine of separate but equal was meant to disguise inequality. in Vermont, civil unions is a way to disguise equality. It's marriage except in name, and it's supposed to be equal. And the whole point is for it to be equal, it just has a different name.
So it's easier to pass by legislators that way because they're not legalizing gay marriage. It's just civil unions.
Yeah, it was a calculation that Governor Dean made at the very outset and the legislative leaders made at the outset. They figured the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, who was really instrumental in pushing this bill through, figured that he could only get maybe 35 votes for a marriage bill, and he would need 76.
How did gay activists in Vermont take to the idea of civil union and not the full-fledged marriage?
I begin my book with the story of the day the ruling was announced, and Beth Robinson was the lawyer who argued the case before the Supreme Court, and she was devastated by the ruling. It was a great victory for her, and yet she was devastated because she wanted the court to come out squarely for marriage. And so she had to go to the press conference about the ruling, and she had to go to a rally where all her supporters were there with, and she had to say, yes, this is a great victory, but we're going to push in the legislature for marriage because that's the only thing that will be equal. And so she was torn. And at the end of the day, she went home and wept because on the day of this great victory, she didn't really get the victory she wanted.
What instructions did Vermont's Supreme Court give Vermont's state legislature when the court said you have to come up with some kind of legal equivalent of marriage for gays, or you have to legalize marriage for gays?
The instruction was just that.
create
marriage or what they called a parallel institution. And the court reserved jurisdiction, which meant that if the legislature had failed to act, then the court could have come back and said, okay, you failed to act, so we're going to declare that marriage is their right.
David Motes is the editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald in Vermont. His new book is called Civil Wars, A Battle for Gay Marriage. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. From BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com. By Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. And from Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on how Vermont became the first state to legalize civil unions for gay and lesbian couples. We continue our conversation with David Motes, author of Civil Wars, A Battle for Gay Marriage.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Motes, author of the new book Civil Wars, A Battle for Gay Marriage. It's the story of how Vermont became the first state to legalize civil unions for gay and lesbian couples. Motes is the editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald in Vermont and won a Pulitzer Prize for his editorials in support of gay civil unions. In 1999, Vermont's highest court ruled that the state legislature had to extend the benefits of marriage to same-sex couples. But the court gave the legislators the option of extending those benefits through civil unions. The issue of gay marriage and gay civil unions is so hot politically. Were the legislators happy or disturbed to be handed this issue?
A lot of them were very disturbed. A number of them heard about the ruling, heard that the court had thrown it into their laps, and they went, oh, no, you know, they thought, I'm doomed. If I vote for this, I'm sure to lose my seat. But so the leadership saw that they needed to act, however, and they took it on and acted quickly. The Judiciary Committee cleared their calendar and dealt with nothing else for a month or so. But many of the legislators were right in a hot seat. I describe one Republican member of the Judiciary Committee, a former state trooper named John Edwards, and he was kind of at a loss. What should he do? And one day he just sat down in a busy room at the State House, people coming and going, and he's had a little conversation with himself, and he decided, well, I just have to go with this. I'll probably lose my seat, but I have to do the right thing. And he said, after that, I was at peace with myself, and he voted for it, and he lost his House seat in the Republican primary the following September.
Did that happen to many other people who voted for civil unions?
16 House members lost their seats and two senators. The House went from Democrat to Republican control. Senate remained in the hands of the Democrats. One senator, he had even been told that he could vote against it if he needed to save his seat. He was a Democrat, Mark McDonald, and he was planning to. He said he had all the justifications, you know, and everybody given permission to vote against it. And a couple nights before, someone called him. He was talking with a friend on the phone and said, well, what are you going to say to your students? He was a high school teacher. What are you going to say to your students that you voted against this just to save your skin? And he came on the floor of the Senate and gave a speech describing this, and he went ahead and voted for it, and he lost his seat that fall. And then 2 years later, he regained his seat. People told him, well, we punished you. We thought we needed to punish you, but now we'll vote you back in.
Was the issue of gay marriage or civil unions discussed in a different way once it entered politics, once it got out of the courts and entered the state legislature?
It was discussed in every which way that you can imagine. It was in the courtroom, you know. It's all legal arguments and quiet, reasonable discussion. And it got into the legislature, and the whole place was turned upside down. The State House was packed with people advocating on both sides, you know. And the people that legislators described for me, the atmosphere was just tense. And And in a way, this is what the Chief Justice wanted in turning it over to the legislature. He wanted to throw it into what he called the political cauldron, and it really was a cauldron. And the reason is that the democratic process would give the outcome greater legitimacy. You know, to involve the people in the outcome would be better in the end. And so it was a great education for the state of Vermont, and he got that outcome. It was an arduous process, but in the end it worked.
Now, you say that the language of the opponents of gay civil unions was so extreme that it pushed some House members toward supporting the bill for gay civil unions. Can you give us an example of some of that extreme language and how it affected legislators?
For example, people would come before the legislature and they would read from the Bible and they would say, you should not put the seal of approval on immoral behavior. And then you had a kind of extreme examples like one House member proposed an amendment to require an HIV test for people who seeking a civil union. And if you either one of the partners tested a positive, you couldn't have a civil union. People were aghast at this and thought that this was just awful, and only two House members supported that amendment.
What were some of the winning arguments in Vermont that led the Supreme Court and the legislature to legalize civil unions?
One of the crucial arguments in all of these cases is the procreation argument. Opponents of civil union and gay marriage say that marriage should be reserved for heterosexual couples because to encourage procreation and care of children by a heterosexual couple. And that sort of seems kind of obvious on its surface, but then you realize that there are a lot of heterosexual couples that don't want to have anything to do with procreation. You know, a couple that's 70 years old might want to get married, but they aren't planning on having children. And then again, there are a lot of gay couples who do have children. Two of the three couples in the case in Vermont, one had an adopted child, one had a child conceived from a sperm bank. And so it was kind of ridiculous to argue that marriage should be reserved for heterosexual couples for the purpose of encouraging stable families in the care of children when there are plenty of gay couples who have children.
Do you know how many people have taken advantage so far of this new civil union law?
There have been more than 5,000. And at the time I was writing, finishing up in the summer, they had come from every state except North Dakota and Montana. And from Canada, only 800 or so of them had been from Vermont.
Is there a Chamber of Commerce that's saying this is really good for business?
Yeah, well, I don't know about the Chamber, but a number of inns have set up package deals and stuff where you can go have a weekend and have a civil union and have a vacation, and they've tried to make a good business of it. There were fears at the time this was being discussed that this would discourage tourism because people would be so disgusted and everything. But I don't think anything like that has happened. Quite the reverse. I think there's been a modest tide of people coming to Vermont.
My guest is David Motes, author of the new book, Civil Wars, A Battle for Gay Marriage. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Motes, author of the new book, Civil Wars, the story of how Vermont became the first state to legalize civil unions for gay and lesbian couples. Motes is the editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald in Vermont and won a Pulitzer Prize for his editorials in support of civil unions. Let's talk about Governor Howard Dean's role in the passage of the gay civil union legislation. What was his reaction when the Supreme Court told the legislature that it had to write a bill, and that would also mean that Governor Dean would have to sign the bill, so it brought him into the controversy in a way that he wasn't involved when it was in the courts.
Right at the outset, within minutes of the release of the Supreme Court's ruling, he called a press conference, and he said, I'm against the gay marriage alternative. I'm for the domestic partnership alternative, which was what it was called then. And he said, I'm glad they didn't go forward with the more radical alternative and so on. And so he staked out his position very clearly. It was a practical political judgment. And he figured there's no way marriage would make it through the legislature. And So he was for civil union. And the legislative leadership came to the same conclusion, and so that's the way it went. After that, you know, he was sort of behind the scenes on it. He wasn't really strong-arming people on it, but he would talk to people sometimes. And then I heard stories, things I hadn't known before as I was researching this book. The bill went to the Senate, and the Senate leadership was nervous. They thought, geez, we're gonna lose in November if we have to really go forward with this. And a couple of the Senate leaders held a secret meeting with Howard Dean up at his office. They even requested his staff not be present. They were afraid that it would become known that they were trying to chicken out. And, well, they went to him and said, can we have a study commission or something? Can we delay this, you know, until after the election? And he said, no way. We have to do what's right. We just have to do this, you know. And so they really gave him credit for being unwavering on it. And so then when he signed the bill, he signed it in private. He had no press, no supporters, no nothing. He said he wanted to avoid the triumphalism of a public signing. Well, people said immediately, of course, that he signed it in the closet. And he came out and held a press conference as soon as he signed it and said why he had done it that way, and that was the reason. He wanted to not – the wounds were still raw, he said, and he didn't want to rub those wounds and make them any more raw. But at that press conference, he also explained why he had signed it and said this is a very important bill for Vermont and for America, and so he's proud to sign it and so on.
Governor Dean said during this period that gay marriage made him uncomfortable, the same as anyone else. What kind of reaction did that comment get?
People rolled their eyes in a way. That's politically incorrect, or it's, you know, the advocates of gay marriage were rolling their eyes, I suppose. But in a way, this is why he has been as popular as he has been, is that's a very candid and frank admission, and a lot of people are uncomfortable with it. He was acknowledging that. A lot of the people in the legislature were uncomfortable with it. That's why it was created such a fury. And so he admitted it and came right out with it. And that kind of, punctures that particular balloon. Yeah, okay, we are uncomfortable with this, but we're going to deal with it.
And, you know, I haven't asked you yet why the three couples who brought this issue to the courts in Vermont did it in the first place. How did these three couples get together and form this this suit for the right to have a legalized relationship?
There's a group in Vermont called the Vermont Freedom to Marry Task Force, and a couple of lawyers, they had this idea that they wanted to do this, and they had set up kind of a speakers bureau, and they would have people go around to Rotary clubs and church groups and so on and talk about the issue. This was even before they got their suit together. And then they found the three couples. You know, they would go to meetings and talk about what they wanted to do, and these three couples eventually came forward. They're very interesting people. They had to be people strong enough to put up with a lot of criticism and a lot of public exposure and so on. And, you know, for example, one of them, a pair of women who had lived together in the rural town of Milton for about 30 years, one a nurse, one a mathematics professor. They had a Christmas tree farm. They'd been part of their church. Just a valuable member of the community. And, well, they heard about this. They said, well, why not? You know, they hadn't been active in gay rights stuff before, but they thought, well, why shouldn't we? And they joined the lawsuit, and, you know, they went down to their town clerk and, you know, who is someone they knew. He was very friendly and polite and everything, but he had to deny them their marriage license, and that formed the basis of the suit along with the other two couples.
Is one of the differences between civil unions and gay marriage that marriage in one state has to be recognized by other states, whereas civil unions do not?
Yes, that's one of the big differences, the fact is that so many states, such as Ohio, and they've passed laws which refuse to recognize any gay marriage from another state. And so even a marriage law will face obstacles in other states. And so it's not as easy as just passing a marriage law. There's a complicated struggle ahead.
Nevertheless, if marriage would theoretically be recognized in any state that hadn't outlawed gay marriage, and civil unions aren't going to be recognized in states outside of the state that it's happened in, isn't that a significant difference that makes it separate and unequal?
Yes, that's exactly right. It's a significant difference, and that is one of the main arguments that the Freedom to Marry people make when they say civil unions is not adequate.
How did your editorial board at the Rutland Herald arrive at its position supporting civil unions in your state, Vermont?
Well, editorial board is kind of an exaggeration. I'm the editorial writer, so there really is. We have a board, and we meet every once in a while, and we talk about stuff. But this was basically my call, and I had support from the publisher, who saw this as basically a continuation of the paper's tradition as a supporter of civil rights and so on. And so I just wrote what I thought I needed to write, and I really was never exposed to any of the unhappiness that might have existed in the advertising department or the circulation department. People in those departments would hear from unhappy readers or advertisers, but that was never, I was never exposed to any of that. So I just did what I thought needed to be done.
How did you arrive at your decision to support civil unions?
The court ruling came out that day in December 99, and I downloaded a copy and I read it, and I thought, well, there's just no way I can not be for this. It's a very strong argument for equal rights, and it was a civil rights issue that was very plain to me. It just seemed clear to me after reading the court decision that this is the way that we needed to go.
Is there anything you'd like to quote from one of your own editorials that would kind of sum up for us the position you struck and the language that you used to make your case to your readers?
I don't have my editorials right here before me, but there's one point that I tried to make during this time, and that is that it was important during this debate to look at the opposition and to recognize that there is there's legitimacy to the opposition on both sides. Of course, there was a lot of bigotry and stuff in opposition, and I'm not talking about that, but there was also legitimate opposition from, for example, the Catholic Church was strongly opposed, and I grew up Catholic, and I know what the Church teaches about sexuality, and I understand that that's a real and legitimate moral teaching that people try to follow, or, you know, they struggle with it sometimes, but this is a legitimate point of view, and on the other side, you have people coming forward seeking recognition for the most important relationship in their life, and seeking recognition and respect for who they are, and this is not some kind of nefarious gay agenda. This is just people trying to live their lives, and so that needs to be recognized also. And when you recognize the humanity of the other side, then tempers can cool down and you can deal with each other with respect and come to some kind of decent outcome. And I tried to help that happen in Vermont.
My guest is David Motes, author of the new book, Civil Wars, A Battle for Gay Marriage. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is David Motes, author of the new book Civil Wars, the story of how Vermont became the first state to legalize civil unions for gay and lesbian couples. Motes is the editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald in Vermont and won a Pulitzer Prize for his editorials in support of civil unions. In your book Civil Wars, you describe the struggle to legalize civil unions for gay and lesbian couples as being similar to some of the big battles in the civil rights movement of the 1960s. I know you weren't a practicing journalist at the time, but, you know, in looking back, you might have wondered, well, if you were practicing journalism then, what would your responsibility be to give kind of equal say to both sides? So I'm wondering if you thought about that issue and if you also thought about it in terms of, you know, the struggle for civil unions in Vermont, whether you saw, you know, both of the sides as equal in terms of the amount of say that they should have in your paper.
Well, I drew a line, for example, with letters to the editor. I drew a line with letters that, you know, were outright homophobic. And just as I don't know that during the civil rights era, I would need to give equal say to racists. But even during that time, you know, opponents to civil rights would make arguments related to federalism, you know, and states' rights and so on. And those were the kinds of arguments that you had to engage in. In the same way with gay rights, you know, there are people that are just full of hate, you know, that's kind of off the chart. You know, there's really no way to answer that. But then there are, however, arguments about whether the courts ought to be doing this, or, you know, the Constitution really justifies this or not. And those are real arguments that can be engaged in. There's also an argument about, you know, how much a role religion ought to play in a secular society. At the legislature in Vermont, we'd have the Catholic bishop coming in one day and saying that he opposed civil unions. Then the next day, the Episcopal bishop would come in and say she supported it. And so, in a way, legislators were in a position, well, what do we do? Who do we believe? In fact, they're not supposed to believe either. They're not supposed to be crafting a law on the basis of what a religious person says. They're supposed to be crafting the law on the basis of the Constitution. And so all of these things can be discussed, but you're right. I think, you know, certain people take themselves out of the discussion when they come forward and they're full of hate.
Looking ahead, how much of a role do you think gay marriage is going to play in the presidential election?
I am not sure. I think the right wing is going to push it hard, and we'll see how much President Bush wants to deal with it. Interesting thing is that civil union now has become sort of the moderate alternative, and most of the Democratic candidates are in favor of civil union, and as opposed to gay marriage. Well, in fact, now gay marriage is going to be the law in Massachusetts, so I don't know what they'll have to say about that. But it's kind of a volatile one that can cut both ways. I think President Bush is reluctant to deal with it because he doesn't want to come off looking mean-spirited, because that's the danger. You try to write something like that into the law, and you're introducing an amendment to the Constitution for the purpose of depriving someone of his or her rights. That's kind of unusual, and a lot of people are going to think that's a very bad idea.
What do you think the odds are that the issue of gay marriage and gay civil unions will remain a state-to-state issue, or, you know, that it will become a federal issue handled through the courts, a constitutional amendment, or Congress?
I think the odds are, I think it's going to be a state-to-state issue for the foreseeable future. It's going to, but the constitutional amendment is going to make it a federal issue. It remains to be seen whether the Republicans, how hard they want to push that or not. That's what would make it a federal issue. And it would be a pretty divisive one, I think.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
David Motes is the editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald in Vermont. His new book is called Civil Wars, A Battle for Gay Marriage. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Cinema Therapy for the Soul, The Girl's Guide to Finding Inspiration One Movie at a Time, by Nancy Pesky and Beverly West. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
One, two, three, five!
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Beatles' arrival in the U.S. We'll hear from Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
So how could I dance?